Good evening. I think you brought someone with you tonight, Forrest. A new face in the Zendo. Welcome. Let's do introductions around.
Britt.
Julian.
Ellie.
Dan.
Edith.
Russ.
Jamie.
Lauren.
Forrest.
Heather.
Lindy.
Ron.
Me too.
Angie. So nice to see you all. Another little piece of good advice from Dogen. This is called The Record of Things Heard, if you all. It's Britt, you want to begin? It's page 59, number 6.
One evening, he said, after Emperor Taizong of the Tang Dynasty assumed the throne, he dwelt in the old palace. Because it was ruined, there was a dampness in the air, and the chilly wind and mist would afflict his jade-like body. When his ministers and others submitted to the throne that a new palace should be built, the emperor said, "It is the farming season, and the people would surely be distressed. We should wait until fall to build it. To be afflicted by the dampness means that one is not accepted by the earth. To be affected by wind and rain means that one is not in harmony with heaven. If one goes against heaven and earth, he cannot maintain his body. If one does not trouble the people, he should harmonize naturally with heaven and earth. So saying that if he harmonized with heaven and earth, they would not afflict his body. After all, he did not build a new palace, but abode in the old building."
Even a worldling thus thought more of the people than of his own body. How much more so should children of Buddha, inheriting custom of the house of the Tathagata, take compassion on all living beings as upon an only child.
One should not revile and torment his attendants or followers on the excuse that they are his servants. How much more so should fellow students and equal companions respect and honor the abiding ancients of venerable years, just as if they were the Tathagata. The words of the precepts are clear about this.
Therefore, students of the present time as well should think of doing what would be good for others, without distinguishing in your hearts between high and low, relative or stranger, even though this does not show outwardly and is known unknown to others. Whether in respect to matters great or small, no one should torment or break the hearts of other people.
When the Tathagata was in the world, many outsiders slandered and scorned the Tathagata. The Buddha's disciples asked, the Tathagata has always taken gentleness as fundamental and has compassion in his heart. All living beings should honor him equally. Why do such stubborn creatures as these exist?
The Buddha said, when I led a congregation in the past, I often reprimanded my disciples with acts of scolding and carping. Because of this, the present situation is as it is. So it is to be seen among the books of monastic rules.
Thus, even if one leads a group, acting as the chief elder in residence, when he is going to correct the errors of his disciples, he should not make use of scolding or criticizing speech. If he just uses gentle words to admonish and encourage, then those who would obey will still obey.
Even more should students completely give up using coarse language to family independence or vilely slandering others. Be very careful.
I think we'll wait until we talk about this a little bit. Thank you, Heather. Mm-hmm. This is about basic morality. And it's so unlike how people think about Zen. I have some long conversations with friends about how to be with students. The Zen teachers are always talking about, and some of them are actual psychologists who work as therapists for their students as well as teachers in the Zendo. Some of them are a bit like parents who try to keep them in line and treat them not quite like children, but not quite, very strictly, actually. There are a lot of very strict teachers. And it just pleases me to hear this just advising, to use gentle words, if you have to admonish somebody. it's not our general idea about Zen. But, of course, Zen comes from the teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. So, of course, I was just talking to someone this afternoon who knows nothing about Zen and was describing it a little bit and telling her that a lot of what Japanese Zen is based on the samurai tradition, the warrior tradition in, what is it, 16th century? No, 18th century Japan, the 1700s. So it's not even very old. It's a fairly new tradition. And the samurai took it on as a great way to be brave. You just put yourself out there. And so it became a very strict and militaristic kind of practice. But what Dogen is recommending here is to be modest in what we need, not having to build a palace. We've seen that in this whole area, how people build palaces and now they can't manage them, and there's a kind of sensitivity and sensibleness about all of this that it's not so fancy or so special. It's a bit like the Metta Sutra in that one should not torment or break the hearts of other people. And may not distinguish between high and low, relative or stranger. All those simple ways of being based on Zazen practice in which we experience how utterly connected we are. So when we stand up, if we've truly been sitting, there is a kind of gentleness in us that's been freed just by sitting down for a little while. But this makes me think what kind of teacher Koban was too, who did not scold or criticize his students at all. But he disappointed us often. And mostly it was because of our own expectations that we had, I guess, too much greed. he wasn't around very much, and we always wanted him to be around more. And we were always sort of knocking on his door and inviting him to things that he couldn't manage. But one-on-one, he was always completely there for us. And certainly there were never any admonishments. And there were a lot of encouragement. I said this afternoon in that conversation that I think encouragement and creating the space for people to discover their own strength and wisdom is best we can do. I like the emperor and his falling down palace. I think that's very cool. It's a bit like Chikoji. There's some people who think it's a shame that Chikoji got fixed up because it was so nice the way it was falling apart. It's like camping. You know, when we camp, we think it's okay to be kind of roughing it. I think Dogen is recommending that we think about camping out all the time in some way. Have the mind of camping out and not expecting too much. Not expecting luxury, especially if other people are going to be impacted by it. Other questions? Jane?
This strikes me as I'm trying to understand in what way is this living the way. How does this help us to understand, to know yourself is to be yourself, to paraphrase Dogen?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other than just being good golden rule common sense and kindness, how is it that it helps us to know ourselves?
Maybe it's more about forgetting yourself. If we truly live in harmony, we aren't so thinking about ourselves anymore. It's more about just being present for everything and everybody that's happening. You know, we're part of the happening, but we don't have to focus on ourselves. And this is a help that way. I mean, the emperor had anything he wanted. He could do a fabulous place with a sunken tub and everything that his heart desired, but he wanted to feel harmony with everything. We tend to isolate ourselves if we fulfill too many of our desires by focusing on ourselves and what we think we need and want. So it's about finding the balance in that. It's extreme what he's talking about, but he's talking to monks.
And is this ultimately for, is this letting life express itself?
Yeah. He's describing a very simple life, and of course our lives are extremely complex, but the truth of it is the same. We just get a whole lot more input. The less self-conscious we are about what we do, the more we just come from the golden rule, the easier it is and the more harmonious. It just does work that way.
Well, wouldn't it be in the self-interest, so to speak, of the king to have his, you know, the people in his kingdom happy? So,
well,
I mean,
yes, there is that.
I mean, or, yeah, he'd be kind of, I don't know, in trouble in some, and that could cause problems.
Yes. But the general tendency is...
Even with a little rundown kingdom is all right. I think that the king is being pretty mindful in his relation to what's going on.
Very good point. Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, as usual, I'm reminded when he says, you know, when he tells us to be nice to people and to not regard higher and lower people, to apply that again to ourselves. It's almost the antithesis of what James said, that you find your place among people by how you treat yourself. And if you kind of treat yourself the way you want to treat others, and hopefully vice versa, then everything becomes, you know, balanced, you know, working, functioning.
Yes.
And if you see, it's almost like the bodhisattva vow. You know, do you cross the shore first, or do you cross the shore and bring others over? And it's both. You can't. You might not take the last step, but to know that you need to help people cross the shore, you kind of have a toe on the other shore already. Yeah. I think Dogen's kind of saying the same thing. You know. Treat others right, but treat yourself right so you can treat others right. There's a chicken and the egg there going on.
Well, we don't tend to feel it. Notice that we belong to each other in that way, in that very intimate way. They're beginning to discover in neurology that we enact each other's gestures in our minds. If you raise your arm, the part in my brain that is arm raising acts as if my arm is raising. It's called mirroring. So anything that happens to us from so-called the outside is happening here in us. Our brains are actually living your life and other people's lives as its own, because it is. Now, if you really look into it, you can't see where it begins and ends. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Today I got feedback that we had a vendor who made a pretty emphatic statement, which I found very annoying. And I responded to him at length to explain why I had done what I had done. And I took care not to express my rotation. I took the stand just to explain what we were doing and to thank him for his comment and to invite him to continue in the comments. And I got the feedback that there's the difference between a vendor, which is this guy, and a partner, who isn't that guy, and that I spent too much time on this vendor. And my response was that relationship is important to me, but that this was a good point, that if perhaps in this case I was communicating by spending the time with him, perhaps it was inappropriate. Because this is how this person has habitually behaved in the past, where they've taken a short view and maybe a little bit selfish. So I can see both points of view. And I guess my question is, excuse me if that's too much context, but I guess my question is, I mean, on the one hand, you know, I thought, okay, well, I always take, my response back to that feedback is, well, I always take time for a relationship. And I thought, oh, you do, is that a rule? You know, so maybe that's inappropriate to always take time for a relationship. And maybe there are times where you know this person, they're always behaving that way, and you need to, you know, cut to the chase. So it's hard to know.
So there's no rule.
I think, and that's what tripped me. That's where I internalized that feedback, because I found myself, oh, but I always
do.
Maybe that's the point, that this feedback was to shake me up out of my rule, and maybe next time I will still take the time, that maybe I'll understand those choices.
Well, that vendor may not have been ever spoken to in that way. That might have made some kind of interesting change in that person's mind also.
And even if it doesn't,
it's from your side. You do the best you can in every situation. And the more you know about a situation, the more you know how best to take care of it. So you've learned something about this, and maybe you'll change, maybe not. Maybe he'll come to you in a different way, or you'll, you know, be more abrupt. You can't even know, really, until it happens, because there's so many things that go into each encounter. So you can wait to see with great interest, what's this one going to be like, you know.
So my frame, you're kind of validating my frame, that my frame is to meet.
Yes.
And you can't go overboard, well, this person's always like this, nor can you go overboard, this is how I always behave to it.
Yes, yes.
You want to be able to meet and see things how they are.
Yes. And honor the boundaries. Honor not only your own boundaries, but that other person's boundaries. So sometimes, especially when we get into this whole thing of relationship and meeting, we tend to drop our boundaries too soon sometimes for people. So it's best to keep our seat and just be open to what's happening and understand it as best we can and bumble through it, basically, because we don't really know until it's over what the right way is, you know. It's all new every time. Yeah. We've got time to read the next one. It's a long one, but not terribly long.
He also said, the concern of a patriarch monk should be to maintain the comportment of Buddhas and patriarchs. Most importantly, above all, one should not covet property and wealth. The reason for that is that the profundity of the Tathagata's compassion is difficult to fathom, even by way of simile. But all that he did was for the sake of living beings. He would not do even the slightest thing that would not be of benefit to living beings.
That is because as long as he was the crown prince of a universal monarch, whereas once he had succeeded to the throne, he could have done with the world as he liked, taking pity on his disciples with treasures and swaddled them with his possessions. Why did he abandon his title and practice begging on his own? Because there must certainly have been some useful conditioning factors, both for the sake of beings of the final age and to help his disciples traverse the way. He did not keep his property and wealth, but practiced begging for food. Thenceforth, those of the patriarchal teachers of India and China, who were also known by others as good people, were all at the extremity of poverty and begged for their food.
In the beginning, when the Zen sect...
No, it's the first...
All the more.
Yes.
Right. All the more do the patriarchs of our sect only exhort that we should not accumulate property and wealth. Even in the scholastic sects, when they praise this Zen sect, above all they praise poverty. In the books and records that have come down to us as well, this poverty is recorded and praised. I have never heard of anyone rich in material wealth who carried out the way of the Buddhas. All those known as good Buddhists wore patched rags and always begged for food.
In the beginning, when the Zen sect was first called a worthy foundation and its meditating monks were considered different from others, it was because even in the old days, when they were abiding amongst others in the teaching halls and disciplined cloisters and the like, they forsook their bodies and were poor people. In the inherited tradition of this fundamental sect, this fact, before all, should be known. You do not need to depend on the reasoning of the words of the sage's teaching. There was even a time when I myself owned fields, gardens, and the rest. And there was a time, too, when I possessed property and wealth. As I compare the state of my body and mind of that time to now, when I am so poor that I hardly have a robe and bowl, I feel that my state of mind right now is better. This is evident proof.
Isn't that interesting? I think this is such a... I never thought about how Buddha could have taken all his wealth and lavished it on the people around him. That he could have kept it and been a famous teacher, like some famous teachers today and in the past, who taught and also were rolling in wealth. Very interesting. He never considered it, I'm sure. It was too long a journey, for one thing. He had to give it all up before he could even know what he was doing. And that Dogen himself, of course, was the child of nobility. His parents died when he was quite young, and he was given to an uncle to raise, and the uncle is the one who put him in a monastery to be raised by monks when he was about 10 years old, I think. So his experience as a rich little boy was 10 years of it. So this little judgment at the end, that it's proof because he feels better than he did then, it's very very touching, but not very helpful for us, except in the sense that begging for food, I don't know what the Japanese word is, but the practice itself is called takuhatsu. And takuhatsu is when the monks go out and offer their bowl at the door of people in the village, offering them the opportunity to practice dana. It's not considered begging, not going and saying, I need food, poor me, could you please feed me? It's to give people the chance to practice. That generosity is considered to be the very first practice of a Buddhist. That it opens the heart. If you can give, they say, even one grain of your own rice to someone else, something happens. There's some kind of, I think, chemical change that happens between the two people when something is exchanged that way. So in that sense, this all can be for us as well. And generosity or giving isn't just about giving a grain of rice or 50 bucks or or a meal. It's also about giving your attention, giving your knowledge, giving your sympathy. We have so much of all of that. And so as we can not only do so-called tatsu, and offer people the opportunity to give to us, but we can also endlessly practice dana paramita, practice generosity. So from that point of view, this is very important for us. It also points out that in our culture, poverty is supposed to be the worst thing. In this kind of monastic practice, it's the preferred thing. So that's a kind of koan for us. What is the value that we place on in a sense our survival as people living in the Bay Area at this particular time who have cars and houses and food in the cupboard? I don't think he means for us to give it all up, but to know what it is. And also, as we're all beginning to discover, know how ephemeral it all is. How easily, how unreal it is, actually. We can see, looking back, what a dream. Everybody talks about it. Oh, why didn't we know these things were happening? It was a dream. Said they forsook their bodies and were poor people. Not trying to always be warm and dry and comfortable. I always think of I've forgotten his name now, the monk who was Kodo Tsuwaki's student. Uchiyama, thank you. And he wrote about himself and his life at Antaiji, where they had nothing. They grew their own food, and they really didn't grow very much. It was too difficult, and they weren't very good at it. they just sat. And he said, I read the paper every day because I want to know when people come and talk to me and want my advice. I want to know what's happening in the world. So every day, at the end of the day, he would read the paper and have a glass of scotch. And he said that helped him to relax and it was medicine for him. And that was his whole life, sitting from very, very early in the morning with his monks all the way through the day, and reading the newspaper, having a little glass of scotch, going to bed early because he was getting up real early. So that was the 20th century version of a life of monkish poverty. I always thought it was kind of amusing, but also kind of touching. I think we have to, each of us, we do create our own life and our own relationship to these, to our needs and wants and our world at the same time. What we're being told is the right way and what's right for us. Well, it's a little bit after 8. I'm sorry. But that was... So we'll be on number 8 next time.